Now this mute button's on, is that?
No, that's just the power button. You didn't press it, did you?
No. Check.
Check. All right, we're good.
The Blue Yeti.
Yeah, this is like a $200. I mean, yeah. The technology, it's so
insane.
Easy now.
It's insane. Yeah.
All right. Let me do a quick introduction, and then we'll blast off into this stuff. Let me see. All right. Hello, and welcome to Comedy Death Star, the podcast that digs into the dark side of comedy. I'm your host, Denzel Myers. Our guest this week is Jordan Brady, former or current stand-up comedian, director of the documentary films I Am Comic and I Am Road Comic. Jordan also directs features and directs commercials here in Los Angeles. You can also hear him on his weekly, monthly podcast.
Weekly?
Occasional podcast, Respect the Process, which is about filmmaking in advertising.
Correct.
Yeah, doing a good job at that kind of
thing. Thank you, Denzel.
We will hear more about all that in a moment. But first, a message from our corporate overlords. Comedy Death Star is a production of Actors Comedy Studio and ACSDigital.tv. I'm Denzel Myers. Our guest today is Jordan Brady. Hello, Jordan.
Denzel, thanks for having me.
It is a great pleasure to have you
it's
here.
It's great to be here in the spacious studios, too.
Spacious studios,
it's
yeah.
Really it's a nice, clean environment, but not. It doesn't have an antiseptic vibe. It's just clean, like create in here.
Not too clean.
Not too clean, but not all hippie eclectic. I've had enough of that.
You had enough hippies?
I have enough of the hippies.
You're not into the hippies.
It doesn't breed comedy.
Why not?
Because it's just like, let the work do the talking. That's what, like a black box theater.
Yes.
Right? It's clean. Yes. Let the work speak for itself.
That's how I got into the theater. I mean, I had been improvising for a while. There's a story behind that. But I went to a black box theater, and they did a production of The Princess Bride. And they had no props, almost no props.
Oh, wow.
And I can still see in my mind that scene where Fezzik is climbing the cliffs of despair and he's pulling the rope. And, you know, there was no scenery, no backdrop. It was just a rope hanging and this big guy, and he's pretending to pull the rope, and two guys are on his back. And the magic really happened.
Theater of the mind, Denzel.
I got to get in here. I got to start to do this because there was nothing there. And I had seen the movie, and it still, it totally rocked my world. So.
Well, that's like at a comedy club, why I love the generic red curtain.
Because?
Well, it just lets the performer stand there in front of the red curtain and tell his or her jokes.
Yeah, and that's all you got.
Yeah.
That's all you got. Now, just to open this up, you know, this show is about the dark side of comedy.
Take me there. I'm ready to go down the rabbit hole of despair. What fuels comedy?
Yeah, what's interesting to you about that? I like that, the rabbit hole of despair. Yeah.
Well, I mean, certainly there are happy people doing comedy.
Really?
Yes, they're totally
happy. Have you met some happy
people? Yes, I'm a happy person. Okay. You know, but one could say that I am not, like in the intro, is a comedian, former comedian. I'm not a practicing stand-up comedian. And I think part of that is because I lead a very happy life. You know, I found another joy and another love. The mistress of filmmaking.
Mm-hmm.
And her siren song called me, and I fell victim because it was a happy place.
And so you need comedy less. You need stand-up
I need comedy less.
Less.
I need stand-up less.
Because you are happy.
Yeah, and I think when you have kids, like a lot of guys have talked about that, you have kids, you know, you want to raise your family, you want to be there. So the nightclub life,
right.
Which fuel is, you know, it's drug-filled, alcohol-fueled, that can lead to a dark place and maybe better comedy.
Right.
But I think that comedy is fueled by darkness. You know, I know that if I'm frustrated with not, you know, people want to be in control.
Well, yeah.
Right? You want to be.
Yeah.
And when you're not in control, like something stupid at the house, right, with my wife or something, like, I want to do this, she wants to do that. And then I do get to go out and do a set of stand-up. I notice that I can unleash. I can barf up these emotions. And they're very funny.
Right.
As opposed to getting on stage going, my wife is beautiful and I love her. And what a great relationship we have. What's funny about that?
There's nothing funny about that.
No.
No, I've tried it, actually. Yeah. It bombs immediately. Well, you mentioned, so what irritates you day to day that then you laugh about? What, I think you have some pet peeves, things that piss you off?
Pet peeves, when people are late.
Well, you were late today.
I was 4 minutes late. I tried to call, by the way. I tried to call several times.
All right.
It goes right to some Muzak.
Oh, yeah.
It's pretty cool, studio, yeah. And then I was lulled. I was lulled by the Muzak. It was nice.
No, I don't really like it because then I think I dialed the wrong number. I don't know where the hell I am. Yeah, so people being late.
People being late. And here's what's worse. When they walk in late.
Yeah.
Can I curse?
I think so, yeah. Okay. Go ahead.
And you get a fucking latte. And it's really hot. And you come in with the latte like, hey, sorry I'm late. No, you weren't sorry. You had to stop and get a Starbucks.
You stopped and got a coffee.
Right. Yeah. Oh, the traffic was horrible. Oh, the traffic at the Coffee Bean?
Yeah. I couldn't find a place to park.
You might as well be holding up the finger.
Right.
But you're holding up a cappuccino.
Right.
So that's a pet peeve because it says your time is more valuable than my time.
I like the image of when I see somebody holding a cappuccino, I'm just going to imagine that they're holding it, they're giving me the finger.
They're flipping you off.
That works for me, actually. Yeah. Tell us about your podcast.
My podcast.
Your podcast.
Oh, can I tell you another pet peeve?
Yeah, tell me another pet peeve.
Because we were talking a little bit before the show. You know, I'm divorced.
Yes.
And it's going on 10 years, but it's been dragging out and dragging out.
What, the legal part?
The legal part.
Are you still not done with that?
Correct.
After
10 years.
Get the hell out of here.
Yeah, it's crazy.
Oh, my God, that's
crazy.
Brutal.
And it's kind of a racket.
That's brutal. Oh, no, it's
totally lawyers, a racket. You know, the lawyers want to come back. The judge, I think they're sliding the judge a cut. Let's come back another day. Let's come back in 6 months.
There is a documentary that came out last year.
Yes.
It's called Divorce, Inc.
Yes.
Have you seen it?
No, but I saw a trailer or something.
It's a muckraking expose of what they call the divorce industrial complex. And, you know, the movie really lays out all the conflicts of interest that are present in the system with the lawyers, judges, social workers, private investigators. The whole process is designed to inflame the conflict, keep it going as long as possible, take as much as your money as possible, and even if you get an honest judge, which is also possible, you know, that person is deciding what's in the best interest of your family. He or she doesn't know you. They may have really different political and social kinds of views. I'm sorry to hear it's taken so long.
Well, I think really, we got a good judge.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. But
I had a nice lawyer, Saul. You know, basically, is who I
and not better call Saul.
That's the template.
Nice lawyer.
And the ex has had some high powered divorce attorneys, Century City type, $600-$700 an hour.
Yeah.
Like, I just wanted to put the money into a college fund for the kids, and it snowballed. And like I said, the judge has been fair. Yeah. I made my mistakes. You know, I'm paying for that.
Sure,
but it drives me crazy that you have to compartmentalize the emotion. Because on one hand, here's this woman that is dragging me through the mud.
Yes.
But on the other hand, she's the mother of my children. She gave me the greatest gift of all.
Yeah.
Two little mitzvahs, right, have happened because of her. And I'll say to my sons, like, hey, did you send that to your mother? You don't forget, it's Mother's Day. I'm doing it because that's the right thing to do. Because
you want your kids to have a good relationship with
of
their
course.
Mother.
Of course.
Yeah.
And you bite your lip and you're like, and so I think that has fueled comedy.
Yeah.
Like, I'll tell a young guy getting married. I overheard a guy on an airplane and he's talking about his marriage.
Uh-huh.
And I said, oh, I hope you have a great wedding. You know, marriage is a twice in a lifetime thing. It's really wonderful.
Yeah.
I've been married 30 years. Not in a row.
Mm-hmm.
And not to the same woman.
No.
And 8 of the happiest years of my life.
Yeah.
And that's about true. Like, if I break it down,
that's
between
good.
My two wives,
yep.
I've had great years with the new one, great years with the first one. Who knows what the third wife's going to say?
I don't know.
Who knows?
But this is a big... It's outside the purview of this show, in a way, but this whole business about divorce in general.
No, but I meant it in the context of fueling
things for
comedy. Fueling, like, I can't just go on a rage.
Right.
And whether it's on stage or with my kids.
Right.
Like, I can't make fun of their mother
right.
in a disparaging way, but I can make jokes, You know, I can turn that anger into hopefully comedy.
Something, yeah. Well, I recently started as a stand-up comic about a year and a half ago.
I'm really sorry.
Thank you. When I met you, I was not doing that, but I got divorced over in the past year and a half for the third time.
Whoa!
And that's what, to process my experience, I got out. I said, I got to do something. I got to take the microphone.
It's cathartic.
It is cathartic. And one thing I realized was, when you get divorced for the third time, you kind of lose the right to say, oh, that was a mistake. And you got to at least be open to the idea that it wasn't a mistake. You know, maybe none of them were a mistake. Maybe there are no such things as mistakes.
I mean, obviously, they ran their course.
Well, obviously, in this area of my life, I have no idea what I'm doing. But whatever it is, I'm really good at it. And the first time I said that on stage, you know, people laughed, and I laughed. But then I went home and I said, wow, you know, there's something to this. What if you took the disaster, what we label as a disaster, and then you make up a story that tries to explain it? What if you just change the label to say, this is not a disaster, this is a massive success, my third divorce? And what story would I write that would support this being, you know, a great success? Like, what am I actually good at?
That's funny.
So I decided, actually, that the one thing I'm proud of in all three of my divorces, well, two things. One, none of them were my choice. You know, I was guy who wanted to keep working at it. I say, look, I don't give up on love. I'm way too codependent. But the thing that I'm really proud about...
That's funny. That's in the act.
Yeah,
that's
in the act. Is that in none of these three cases did we hire lawyers or go to court and fight about it.
Oh, high five.
In all three cases, I bought this book called How to Do Your Own Divorce in the State of California.
You bought the same book three times?
Well, now I bought it four times because, it's not easy. But we sat down, you know, you sit down with your insignificant other and you work out something. And I did all the paperwork myself.
Oh, that's awesome.
So I realized that's
awesome.
That's what I'm actually really good at.
You can be an inspiration to other couples that need to break up.
Well, that is actually my goal. So based on that...
And that's a whole other podcast, by the
learning,
way.
Well, it's getting bigger because I've turned that into pitching a reality TV show that is a DIY your divorce reality TV show.
Oh, I love it.
And, you know, you could go to court and beat the shit out of each other, like 10 years, whatever you guys are doing. I mean, everybody's got a story of somebody, maybe them, that has had a horrible divorce and cost tens of thousands of dollars. Their kids suffer, drags you, like you say, through the mud for a month. Or you can try to work it out yourself. So I'm a life coach. You know, we would help you.
Yeah.
So I'm pitching that as a reality TV show. And and I'm starting a business as a DIY divorce coach.
Oh, I love it. First of all, I'm an assistant life coach.
An assistant? What the hell does that mean?
An assistant life coach is a guy, you know, he blows the whistle. He goes, come on. Come on, coach is coming. Let's get ready. Kind of preps your clients before you show up in the room.
Look busy.
It's kind of nice. Wear those stretchy shorts. That's an assistant life coach.
The spandex.
It's not really spandex. It's a polyester product that, you know, the assistant coaches wear.
So basically you're confessing to us now on international radio that you wear Spanx.
Of course.
Okay.
Of course. I know that, you know, those compression pants that are popular now?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I call them tights because I love wearing tights. I've been waiting all my life to be able to tell people that I wear tights.
You wear tights.
Now, you know, you use compression pants. You can actually buy them without the shadow of shame.
So you've been wearing them your whole life.
My whole life.
They've been hidden.
Yeah, well, they weren't marketed to men.
Right, right.
The first time I went back to divorce court.
Yes.
I did not have a lawyer. Mm-hmm. And I went in and I thought that I filled out the paperwork right. She had the high-powered attorney.
Right.
Who ripped me a new a-hole with just like form numbers, and he didn't fill out the A-29-6. He didn't do this. He didn't file a QH. I mean, all this stuff that my head spun. And I got up, I said, Your Honor, I am no match
for this Ms. asshole.
Schwartz. Yeah, for Ms. Schwartz. I am no match. Whatever I did wrong, I'm just here to say, you know, there was a recession. I don't make as much money, blah, 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 yada, yada. Can we be fair? And that's taken the last 5 years.
So you said Ms. Schwartz was your wife's lawyer.
That's a fictional lawyer.
Okay, because I know of a lawyer named Ms. Schwartz, a divorce lawyer.
Oh, you do?
I do.
What's her first name?
Link.
Yes, that was
Link
her.
Schwartz is your wife's...
She was.
Yeah.
She was. She got a new one.
Yeah, all right.
Are you friends with Link?
Yeah, I am.
Would she be listening to the show?
Would you like her? I could let her know that you're on the show. We haven't said anything bad about her, so she
Oh, no, I would never say a bad word. In fact,
I just,
here's how much I respected Link Schwartz.
Uh-huh.
Once the ex got a new attorney...
Yes.
I was wondering, is it a conflict of interest for me to hire Link?
Yes, it is. She can't.
Because Link, she was like leaps and bounds above Saul.
Right.
So, I mean, it literally like I just got a guy to help, and I knew him through a bro.
Yeah.
Using air quotes.
Yeah,
listeners.
I get it. That's not a good
And credit. Yeah, Link was, she was sharp.
Yeah. No, I met her because I called her about my show and said.
Oh, she'd be great.
Well, yeah. No, there is a. There is a part on the show for the biggest asshole lawyer I can find, like the biggest sharks, because in any kind of negotiation...
Maybe you don't want Link to hear this now. Is it?
No, I'm not sure. I think she would actually be pretty good. She needs to be more obnoxious. But in any negotiation, you know, they advise you need to know what is your best alternative to a negotiated agreement.
Yeah.
Right? If we can't negotiate, what's the other side? So on the show, we're going to have these jerk lawyers who are really flashy and say, look, if this fails, we'll take your case on and we'll crush that bastard. And so that is always in the background as the alternate path. Right? Not everyone's going to make it through the end of the show. Right? Not everyone's going to succeed with the DIY challenge. Right? Some people might just decide to go right to court in the middle of the show, and that's what they're going to get.
You know, I will say, way back when, it must have been 2007,
we
went to a mediator. I said, let's go to a mediator and put the money into... Are we too off topic? I don't want to
do that. No, this is the show.
You know, I go, hey, well, let's go to a mediator. So we go to the mediator. I go, I'll pay for the mediator.
Yeah.
And at that point, money was pretty good, right? And I go, you know, the way I think it should work is I write down a number and I slide it across the table and you look at that number and you either write on it or circle it and you slide it back.
Right.
And so I wrote down a number. The next time I showed up, not only was the X there, but so was Link.
Uh-huh.
And I was like, oh, this, you know, you brought a gun to a knife fight. The rules were we were going to have a knife fight.
Right.
And in the end, it was... about the same number that I had slid across the table, but 6-7 weeks later.
I see that's the process doesn't work. Anyway, can
I wrap it up with this?
Yeah, sure.
The silver lining.
Uh-huh.
You had said like if you could rewrite the narrative, like maybe it wasn't an accident.
Yeah,
I like to think that I'm in a happier place.
Yeah,
and I like to think because I love my wife. And
your new wife.
My new wife.
Yeah.
And I love my ex-wife. She's mother of my children. It's just a different kind of thing. But she has had a couple of boyfriends. She's too smart to remarry. Very too smart. She's a very smart woman. But
She divorced you.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. Yeah. I'd like to think that she found better matches for her. Like the process of being young, getting married, having kids, you know, buying a house, going on vacation, breaking up, led us to become different people who then found better matches.
Well, now you've gotten really to the heart of this whole thing, which is what do you shoot for in life? I mean, you can shoot for getting everything right and being happy and having it all work out.
That's boring.
I say it's boring, but I don't know because I never have succeeded at doing that.
Right.
I do believe that, you know, the reasons that I have gotten married and whatever has brought me here was stuff that I really needed to know. I needed to see and to do it. So, yeah, shit happens. I don't know if everything happens for a reason, but whether you learn from that is completely up to you.
Agreed.
And you could just be bitter and say that person's an asshole and or I made a mistake and I'm never going to do that again. But if you open it up and you really want to learn something, that's the juice. That's the reason.
That's the juice.
Yeah. I'll just tell you, my most recent ex-wife, I had known her before we got married for 12 or 13 years. And we kind of would connect, and then I would freak out and run away, and that happened like 5 or 6 times, like before my second marriage and after my second marriage. And it just never made sense to me. And one day I was talking to her on the telephone. She lived in another state because we had remained friends. We're still friends.
Sure. You know?
And I hung up the phone and I said, what is it with this woman? For the past 12 or 13 years, there's something about her that completely hooks me and at the same time freaks me the fuck out, like terrifies
me. Yeah.
And it just won't change. It hasn't gone away. It hasn't changed. I don't understand. Well, the only way to deal with that is to ask her to marry me, was to run at it.
Wow.
And get closer to it.
You run with the bulls. You jump right in.
I am a Taurus.
Yeah.
And I don't know, I don't think I've decided to do this, but you know, when you get to be 50, you start to say, oh, what the hell have I been doing my whole life? And I realize that what I do is to identify the things that scare the shit out of me. And then they're like a red flag. I just put my head down and I run towards it at full speed.
Right. And it's a little OCD too, right? You have to, it gnaws at you until you
there's something
conquer it or until you confront it.
Yeah, there's something for me there and I don't know what it is. And I've
Well, what do you think it is? Was there any childhood trauma?
I think that what I see are some limitations. I think that I see things that are holding me back. Or, when something scares you, like the first time I did an improv class, I was so terrified, I thought I was going to throw up. And everyone else is laughing because they're just introducing the first exercise. And I really want to run. And at the end of the day, I said, I don't know what happened for me there, but whatever it is, I need to do more of this. I need to understand why this scared the shit out of me.
Yeah. Well, part of it, I think
and
part
that's changed my whole life. That was 15, 16 years ago. My whole life is different because I was willing to go at this thing that I didn't understand, except that it terrified me.
But I think that's the thrill. Part of the thrill of whether it's stand-up, sketch, or improv, but like stand-up, if you go up and do the same routine, it becomes rote, and that's why guys change it up or ad-lib, or you know, if you riff on the room, there's a thrill to that.
Yes.
Improv, there's a thrill because you never know what you're going to do. If it's a new play or a new sketch, there's that initial, holy shit, is this going to work moment.
Yeah,
and maybe that's with love, or with your recent fourth ex-wife.
I have third
ex-wife.
Yeah, I don't know if people ask, "Are you going to get married again?" And I'm like, I don't know. Maybe
it depends. You might.
But I do know one thing: the next time I get divorced, I want it to be forever.
Yes. Have you ever married the same woman again?
No.
Yeah.
No. I haven't done
that.
That's
a weird one.
That didn't.
That's a weird one. That's like fool me once.
Yeah.
There's an old saying in Tennessee.
Sex with the ex, that's a different story.
Well, here's the thing.
Getting remarried again.
But sex with the ex, and I can't speak to that because I went right into another relationship.
So let's just say for the record, this is conjecture. And
yeah, this is all conjecture. Go ahead. Right? This is for the sake of the podcast.
For the show.
But as I told my boys, my sons, probably when they were like, hitting puberty, what is that, like 11, 12?
12-ish,
right?
Yeah.
I said, boys, I'm going to tell you something that's going to affect you the rest of your life. And listen close. The dick don't lie. The dick don't lie.
Meaning?
I'm attracted to all kinds of people, right? Shapes, sizes, genders, colors, races. I don't care.
Right.
If there's a chemical thing that sparks, right? I know like, oh, wow. Because I'll see somebody at the farmer's market. Trader Joe's.
Farmer's market.
Farmer's market's generic, right?
Well, it's also, organic. So it's
a little tougher, right?
Yeah.
So let's say you're at the Trader Joe's and I said something to one of my boys. They're older. They're 20 and 22 by the next month. But it's a year ago, and I go, "Oh my goodness, she is hot! Look at that!" Like, Dad, are you kidding? I go, "What did I tell you when you were younger? I think there's no apologizing for what you're attracted to,
or sometimes even explanation."
No, there's no explanation.
Right.
And the other thing, and I hope no one listening takes this the wrong way, but two freaks will find each other. Like, you're at a party, and you can't always act on it. Like, I'm a monogamous man, yeah, right?
Married guy, you know.
Married guy.
Stuff, yeah.
But you're at a party, and someone looks, and you look, you know instantly. Like, they're a freak. I know. People have said stuff. I'm like, yep, in another lifetime, in another universe, mm-hmm. you and I would get freaky with various toys and implements and corsets. It would be crazy.
And organic vegetables.
Organic vegetables, yeah.
One of those oils. Beets, those yes. big beets, yeah. yeah. Well, last thing on this subject, because I want to ask about I Am Comic and I Am Road Comic movies. But, I've been doing a little online dating recently because,
yeah.
you know, that's the thing to do these days.
How and could you not as no, a single
you,
man?
You have to do that.
Yeah. By the way, you're very handsome. And don't couple that with, like, what I said earlier. But I do
well,
feel. I mean, I do feel a little something between
a little
us,
spark.
But a little
right.
spark. But as an attractive single man,
yeah.
I would think online dating would be a time saver.
Yeah, I imagine. I mean,
right?
We'll have to see how
saves
it goes.
On gas.
Saves on gas. Well,
drinks.
Meet the people in person, but
eventually,
yeah better. Yeah. But there's this thing, this. Fiction out there, and you've heard it. Whenever you get a breakup, I mean, the people who say, well, you need to know what you want, you know, in your next relationship. And I realize that's the opposite. That's dumb to me. Like, this is love. Why would I want to know what I want and then get it? I'm not ordering a fucking sandwich.
Right.
This is love and life. I want to be surprised. I want to be fucked up. I want to be confused by love.
If love were predictable and ordered a la carte, what would be the fun?
Yeah, I don't want something and then get what I want. Well, that doesn't make any sense to me.
Do you think that's what was wrong with the first three marriages?
No, I think that was right with what was right with the first three marriages. Although my second marriage, I did say I would like to marry an artist. And my second wife was a writer,
mm-hmm.
and it was good. It got me closer to a creative person's life because I was a business
yeah.
guy. And just having that proximity gave me some permission to open some new thing up. And life totally changed. And she got jealous about it because she wanted to be the creative person and she wanted me to be like the business guy who paid all the bills.
Yeah.
And so that was part of what didn't work for us, but it totally worked for me. I changed. She wanted me to stay the same. But I got that. In that case, actually, maybe I did know what I want, and I got it. And that's why the marriage went south. But
so I'm clear. Did you seek an artist? Like, I'm with online dating, I realize you can be very specific, right? It's a search engine.
Yeah.
Right? It's
well,
like,
this was a little earlier. It was, you know, yeah, 98, 99.
Ooh, yeah, that was dial-up internet
at
best. Right?
No, somebody,
yeah.
some friend had
pre-Google
mentioned,
era, that doesn't count.
A friend had said, oh, yeah, you know, this is something that he was interested in. I knew that, and I was like, it just resonated with me. Yeah, an artist would be good. And so I met a woman who's a writer, and
But you didn't go out seeking, like, I'm going to find an artist, or did you? Or you met her and went, this is so wild, this is kismet. I was thinking about finding an artist. And here I found one.
It was kind of somewhere in between. Like once it mm-hmm. was on my radar, it was there. It was
right,
in my
right,
field.
Right, right.
And when I met her, I was like, oh, yeah, this works in that regard. And all that other stuff that you mentioned about the supermarket and you see someone and
it's there.
The freaky thing happens, yeah.
You know, it's interesting that you can have these thoughts that you think become a self-fulfilling destiny. Is that the right? Like
maybe.
A prophecy.
Yeah.
You
yeah,
think,
sure,
oh, I want it. I willed that to happen. And other times you can go, oh, that's just coincidence. Like something. I think sometimes we make too much out of. That's why I asked you if you thought,
right.
oh, my God, you had this eureka moment. I wanted art. I just told my friend. And here she is in a cafe with a beret.
Well, I don't believe in that kind of crap because what we say is coincidence. Our conscious mind is so much smaller than what we think it is. And there's
really?
All Oh, yeah.
Everyone says it's our conscious mind.
Our conscious mind.
Yes.
Yeah. And so our semi or subconscious is always working and doing stuff, and we just don't realize it. So when we're like, wow, that's amazing, it's not that amazing. You know, you are just following – something else is steering than what you think is
right.
steering.
I would agree with that.
And it's leading you to the thing you really need, and you're just a dumbass because you don't realize that it's all working for you. And all right. Let's switch it up. I want to ask some questions about your films. Is that okay?
Absolutely.
Yeah. Tell people who may not be familiar, I Am Comic, I Am Road Comic.
I Am Comic has 86 comedians
really,
in it?
Really, that many?
Oh, from Roseanne Barr, Sarah Silverman, Jeff Foxworthy, Louis C.K., Nikki Glaser, who's on Comedy Central now, Chris Hardwick on Comedy Central. A lot of Todd Glass, Dave Attell, Tommy Davidson, Tim Allen, Janine Garofalo, Carrot Top.
Yeah, I
so
remember Carrot Top.
Notice that I, to me, they're all comedians.
Yeah.
But I don't care if they use props or their gender, their shape. It's kind of like love.
Right.
They're comics.
Yeah.
And that's why it's called I Am Comic. And it explores the art and occupational hazards of being a stand-up comedian. And because my background, I was a comedian traveling for decades, and before I got into filmmaking, I always, here's what would happen. I would be on set of a commercial.
Mm-hmm. As a director.
As a director.
Yeah.
Yeah, as a director. And there's a thing called the video village where the client and the agency, ad agency, are huddled around monitors with nothing to do. So as the Google era came about, you know, somebody would Google and they'd be like, hey, we saw that you were a comedian. What was that like? And I would tell these stories about being on the road and, you know, going from club to club and having sex with waitresses and, you know, going to people's towns, making them laugh, taking their money, leaving.
And the so, great American tradition.
It was like vaudeville. And then I thought, you know, I'm just going to make a documentary to answer that question. And there's been some great comedy documentaries before that and a great number of them since. And I'm proud that I Am Comic, available on iTunes. It was on Netflix for a while, Showtime, and everything. It's kind of ran its life, but it's, you know, it still does well on iTunes.
Well, it's still really relevant to me, but
The biggest compliment are comedians, that young comedians that come up and say, I loved your movie. It kept me going when I thought I was ready to give up. A woman came up to me in Burbank at Flappers, you know, a comedy club. She goes, I was in bed after my divorce with no life. What was I going to do? And your movie came on Showtime, and I moved to L.A. to pursue stand-up comedy.
Wow.
And she's a flourishing comic to this day.
Now, there are two things I wanted to ask about in there. One is, like you say, the film is about the occupational hazards of stand-up comedy. So I would like to hear a little more about what those are.
Well, I feel like they call it the comedy condo. Mm-hmm. But really, it's an apartment in the shitty part of town with some Salvation Army furniture.
Right.
So you know not to use any of the condiments. Because there was rumored one guy put his dick in the mayonnaise.
Right.
So things like that.
Yeah, I understand.
Yeah, so you don't – and I'm not trying to be crass.
But it's all true.
It's all real stuff.
It's all true, yeah.
And, you know, and it, like I was traveling as a young man in the late 80s, and you would have to wait until the club owner turned the cash over in cocaine. So you're waiting until 3 in the morning until – you know, Johnny comes back with the cash from selling a few eight balls to get paid for the show. And meanwhile, you're doing drugs and partying. It's crazy.
You're hanging out.
So it's an occupational hazard.
Well, I saw I Am Comic, and it's brutal. It's brutal. I mean, just the moment-to-moment, day-to-day life out there telling jokes. You can see how deeply unhappy so many comedians really are.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And I think part of the struggle is during the day you have nothing to do.
Right.
So you're going to sleep. How many times can you go to the mall? Right? How many cartoons can you watch? How much weed can you smoke? For me, salvation was I had a video camera and I would go shoot during the day, and that became a new passion.
Right.
But without it, I think I would just be lazy and unhappy. Yeah.
But probably people that are not in this world think, hey, stand-up comedy, it's glamorous, it's fun, it's exciting. I mean, I'm sure it has those moments, but show the underbelly, you know, the rest of the time. If you're on stage for 10 minutes, you got 23 hours
to
and
kill.
50 minutes to kill, yeah.
I think, well, currently we're in this, what I think is a third comedy boom.
Yeah,
there was the 80s boom. There was like a 2000 boom with Comedy Central bringing stand-up back.
Yep.
Now there's like concerts. It's so funny. There was just an article about the one-hour special.
I read an interview that you did a year ago where you guys got into talking about, you know, this. Yeah, the ruining the one-hour special.
I've talked about it before. But,
yeah.
There was a recent article a week or so ago. But yes, okay. I've talked about this. I did a special for Maria Bamford, truly inventive comic. Yeah. Who talks about her own mental illness. Yeah. She got a new Netflix show coming out. Like, what a treat. But that, and she, okay, that to me is a special because she hasn't oversaturated the market with her stand-up. Now it seems like there are people that churn out cookie-cutter specials. So the comedy special is now the new comedy album. Like for the last 10 years, it's been everybody had a CD, they would sell it after the show.
Right.
Well, if you're making, like I read the article where somebody's making, we're going to make 60 stand-up specials this year. Well, isn't that by definition no longer special?
It's not special. that's more than one a week.
But to answer your question, I don't think the people doing the theaters are miserable. You know, like Brian Regan is one of my favorite comedians and Jim Gaffigan. Everybody loves the Louis C.K. He doesn't seem miserable. He's producing his shows and things like that. He keeps busy and
happy. What he wants to do.
Yeah, he seems like a very unhappy place. But the other guy's doing, you know, you got a tour bus and you're doing theaters. Life's pretty good. You bring your family with you. It's the road comic, which I Am Road Comic was the sort of a follow-up.
Right.
It happened by mistake. A guy calls me up. A comedian who had made a documentary saying, hey, I'm new to making a documentary. It's about this comedy class. Can you give me some notes? Tell me if my film makes sense. We talk. It was an old friend. By the way, I book a club up in Washington State. Do you want to headline? And I go, well, no, I don't headline. I just made that movie after I haven't done it in 20 years.
Right.
He goes, oh, then co-headline. You know, you can split the time. Take a friend. I go, no, you don't understand. I can't co-headline. I can't do... He goes, well, how much time can you do? I go, I bet I could wing 20 minutes. He goes, okay. So he booked me. So I took a camera and I documented the whole weekend.
Right.
It's called I Am a Road Comic, available at iamroadcomic.com for $5. And it's on Hulu for free.
All right.
You sit through commercials.
Yeah, that's cool.
Yeah.
Now, I think I read somewhere that you have the next project in this series is I Am Boat Comic, which is a cruise ship floating borscht belt, you know, of old geezers telling old jokes. I mean, is that real? I want to see that. I want to meet, if that really exists, I want to meet those people.
I Am Boat Comic will happen, but it is landlocked at the moment.
Okay,
that ship is not sailing for two reasons. One, that I want to show the old geezers. And like, I mean, there's guys, it used to be a badge of shame to be a boat comic.
Right.
Now, they're great gigs.
Yeah, it's a whole new industry. Yeah.
And the problem I'm having is, let's say I want to do Princess or Caribbean Cruise.
Carnival Cruise.
There's stuff that they're not going to want me to do.
They don't want you to do.
I can't show the underbelly of the boat.
Got it.
So it's not going to be as interesting, and I can't figure out a way to do it. So I am going to the Middle East in a couple weeks.
Yeah.
I'm going to film that, and hopefully that'll be I Am Battle Comic.
Right.
Because there's a long lineage of performers, comedians.
Oh, yeah, Bob Hope.
Bob Hope, yeah.
Sure.
I mean, that's all you think of when you think Bob Hope.
Yeah. But I love the idea of I Am Boat Comic. I mean, I'm not even sure if those ships have, like, those old guys that I would really like to meet. I'm not sure that that's where they are. But I love the idea that, you would have like some guy that's anachronism from a different different time, you know.
Well, get this.
And he's out on these boats telling old jokes to old people.
We did a show. My wife made a wonderful film called Free to Be Me about these dancers, young people dancers with Down syndrome. Okay. And it's uplifting. FreeToBeMe.com. There's the plug.
Yeah.
So we are involved with this, the Free to Be Me dance organization. They have this fundraiser. And one of the comics was a cruise act, a boat comic. And he's singing jokes that are, you know, very clean.
Yes.
And you think for these families and the kids in the audience with Down syndrome and their siblings, it's a very loving, nurturing environment, appreciative of these performers. And we're invited to the gala, and this guy starts doing impressions of Louis Armstrong or Jimmy Stewart. And there's a guy in his 50s going, "Do you have anybody current? Like I'm 51.
Right.
I wasn't alive.
Right.
I only know through show business." Someone posted on Facebook like they were showing their kids Bugs Bunny talking to Humphrey Bogart. Well, who knows who that is?
Right. Well, I have a special place in my heart for Bugs Bunny.
Oh, well, no, I meant Humphrey Bogart.
No, but the Bugs... Well, that in particular. Like, when I was a kid, I feel like I got educated through Bugs Bunny, Mad Magazine, and the Three Stooges. Because
you and I could have been brothers.
They were all making fun of something that I didn't know anything about because it was from a different decade or, you know, I was a kid and they were making... But I got that this was satirical. And I would learn, you know, from the reflection of the thing I couldn't see, some things about the world. And, you know, I consider that in retrospect a fantastic education. Like the first time I read or watched the movie of One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest.
Oh, yeah.
I laughed through the whole thing because I had read the mad parody of it, you know, like 15 years before, which was, I didn't realize how funny it was at the time, but then when I saw the real movie, so anyway.
You were laughing in the past.
I was laughing in the past.
In the present, you're thinking of the parody.
Yeah, something like that, yeah. So, well, I think those things are useful. I get that they don't. You know, the kids are like, "Who's Jimmy Stewart?" or "Why are you making fun of Humphrey Bogart?"
Well, the live show specifically. But I agree with you that I didn't know who Jimmy Durante was until someone told me when I saw him on Bugs Bunny. There's a very famous Bugs Bunny where he goes through the bar and they're all there.
Yes, yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So that one in Mad Magazine, if you don't know the reference, you miss the joke.
Right.
Right?
Although there was a great Mad parody. This was in the 70s, right? They're kind of early mid-70s. And they did a parody of My Fair Lady. And the two men, the professor and the other thing, they cast those parts as Gloria Steinem and Bella Abzug. And they were looking to take the most male chauvinist pig and convert him to be the perfect man.
Oh, funny.
And so they picked Burt Reynolds. And so, you know, I'm like 10 years old in 1972,
yeah.
And I don't really know any of what the hell's going on, but I got, you know, they rewrote all the songs, you know, and the whole thing happens, and later in life when I actually figured out what it was, I thought that was hilarious. It's just always really stuck with me.
There's something else Mad Magazine did really well. They would draw the boobs larger than life. They would exaggerate the boobs, which I think appealed to the 12 to 15-year-old boy. Like, you didn't know it at the time, but they only had a lot of... Consciously, you don't know, but that subconscious you talked about is working overtime on this cleavage.
Subtext. Cleavage. Yeah. Cleavage is subtext.
It works.
Cleavage is subtext. I had another... I got a lot of questions. Let's switch it up a little bit.
Switch it up. It's your show. You can ask me anything.
I know. I feel
open
like
book,
we have
open
that
book,
kind of thing.
Yeah. I just want to make sure it's interesting to your listeners.
Yeah.
Like the divorce thing, I thought was very personal. And then, like, if we could help one person, man or woman, either save their marriage.
Yes.
Or tell them it's okay to break with thee and move on.
Yeah.
You know, I think the thing that you and I share is don't look at it with regret. I mean, shoulda, coulda, woulda isn't going to help you. You're here now.
Well, and also if you look at it that way, you get locked. It's easy to get locked into blaming the other person for your current situation, instead of saying, "Well, you know, I married this. I brought myself here. You know, what was that about?" But I agree. If I can help somebody not increase the fighting pain problem of getting divorced, and they could just say, okay,
I want to see the show.
Let's walk away.
Yeah, I want to see the show.
You know, it's hard to sell the show, and I'll tell you why.
You got
to
make it.
It's got to be visual. Television is visual, right? If you do hillbilly hand fishing, you know, where the guys stick their hand in and the catfish swallows their fist and they pull the fish out, I know what I'm going to see immediately.
Yeah.
But in this case, it's a lot of talking.
Right.
And there's a challenge just to make it visually interesting.
Well, yeah, there's courtroom dramas that succeed.
Anyway, I'm working on that.
Switch it up.
I want to ask about your work with commercials.
Anything.
You direct commercials.
Yes.
You
love
it. That.
Love it.
You're doing a workshop in New York about teaching people how to do that well.
Wow. April 16th, 2016, I'll be in New York City, Commercial Directing Bootcamp, commercialdirectingbootcamp.com. Thank you for asking.
Yeah.
It is not a film school. It's a seminar that gives you a peek behind the curtain of what it takes to be a commercial filmmaker.
Okay.
So, like, how to deal with the agencies, how to sign with a company, how to get representation to get your work out there, how to do spec commercials, like a fake commercial.
Yeah, like so the Doritos thing. I mean,
that's its own beast.
That's its own thing.
Yeah,
but
that's its own thing. I'm talking about commercials you make, like you're going to do a Tide commercial.
Got it.
And how to make it look like not one you did on your own.
Got
make it look like it should be on TV.
Right.
And then how to work with your crew. And then there's film tips and, you know, things I've learned. Like in traditional filmmaking, you want to start with the wide shot. And then you move into the medium and then the close-ups. In a commercial, this is just an example, I preach, start with a close-up.
And then show
get the meat of it. Because that's what's going to matter.
Got it.
In 30 seconds, you may not even use the wide shot.
Got it.
And the agency and the client are going to fuss over everything in that wide shot. It's going to take 2 hours. But if you do it at the end of the day, like, the wide shot.
If you start on the bowl of cereal, your client will never complain.
I once shot the tennis shoe at noon, and the client said, "Thank you for shooting the tennis shoe. I'm going to fly back to Portland and leave early. I don't know how to do comedy," as the guy says. He goes, "What am I going to tell you about shooting comedy? But I know how I want my shoe to look."
So you covered what the client cared about first.
Why not?
And then they were free to leave.
It's business.
Interesting. So the question I have in here, that was interesting, is what is changing here? I mean, so much of our media landscape, right, is all not the same today as it was 10 or 20 years ago.
Yes. Nothing. Nothing has changed.
What's changing in this world of television commercials?
You have to tell a better story.
You got to tell a better story.
You got to tell a better story. You got to make it pretty. You got to make it funny. You got to make it serious, whatever. The Super Bowl was lackluster, I think, with ads this year.
Yeah.
There were a couple of great ones.
What did you like in the Super Bowl?
I liked the Prius. Mm-hmm. I happen to know the actor, but that's beside the point, who's singing like "Heck Yeah," and I just thought it was fun and it was kind of epic.
Yeah.
I liked the there was a poignant one. Oh, NASA, it was an astronaut. Maybe it was Neil Armstrong, and it was for Audi.
Yes.
And it didn't, at first I'm like, oh boy. And then it tugged my heart because it spoke to my generation and the millennials. Like, the young man comes in, takes the guy for a ride, and they're happy.
Yeah.
I like that one.
You did?
Yeah. For comedy purposes.
That one bugged me.
Why did it bug you?
I thought it was really heavy-handed. I mean, there's a young guy with a flashy car. And he comes to pick up his elderly dad, who is not quite in assisted living, but it has the, you know, aura of that.
Sure.
And the dad used to be this astronaut, and all he has left is memories. And then, you know, the kid says, "Why don't you get in the car?" And, you know, he relives his thrill of being an astronaut because his son is driving this car. And I just say, come on, man.
Is it because you're too savvy?
I don't know.
Because you worked in advertising.
I don't know.
And you saw it coming.
I felt heavy, but you know, honestly, it doesn't matter what I think. If it connected with you, and it touched your heart, that makes it effective.
I liked it.
That's effective advertising.
And to your point, I hated. Hate's a strong word. I shouldn't say hate.
Okay, we're in the business. So we don't say
I did not appreciate baby monkey puppy or whatever that one was. And it doesn't matter because I'm not the 14-year-old that's supposed to buy whatever that was for.
Right, right.
For them, it seemed that seemed to me like it was trying really hard to be a viral, you know, again, yeah. the air quotes, viral hit.
Right, right.
And the animation was bad, and it just, I didn't like it. I thought it was trying way too hard, but it doesn't, it, like you said, it touched a lot of people. It was a hit. People were talking about it.
Well, that's what's important. The difference. And so when you say things are, you know, there's more competition than ever for our time and our attention, and yeah.
So it's got to stand out. I think
it's got to stand out.
Yeah, it doesn't matter. I have a podcast called Respect the Process, right?
Where you talk about these issues.
Yeah, it's on iTunes. It's free. Respect the Process. RespectTheProcessPodcast.com is, I think, what it is. It's all at JordanBrady.com.
Okay.
That's yeah, like it's all there.
It's all there
at JordanBrady.com.
JordanBrady.com.
Thank you. So I talk about making – like, it's one – the biggest compliment was a guy called it the Rosetta Stone of filmmaking, because I've had on the wardrobe stylist, the stunt driver – the creative director, many directors, producers, copywriters, art directors, production designers, like from cast, crew, production, advertising agencies. And recently a marketer said how you have to know where your commercial is going to be playing, like a mobile phone or a computer. I disagree. And I told him on the podcast, like, it doesn't matter. It's going to play everywhere. So wherever
it's
you consume media,
at
the gas pump, on the back of an airplane, I Am Road Comic is on United Airlines for free. Like, you could be in seat 27C and see I Am Road Comic, and that used to piss me off. Like, you know, my movie wasn't meant to be seen on an airplane on a 12-inch screen. I'm like, well, that's bigger than an iPhone 4.
That's true. At least somebody's watching it.
It doesn't matter. It just has to be good. And that skip button, oh, that's deadly.
It is deadly.
And so creativity,
yeah,
I think, thrives when there are rules, when there are boundaries.
Yeah.
You know, they say it's the mother of, you know, necessity is the mother of invention.
Yes.
Well, the necessity of having rules, like I like the 30-second formula. Mm-hmm. So at my boot camp, you know, everyone always asks, can it be like 34 seconds? I go, to me, no. Because
well,
the rules of the
NBC,
game.
NBC, the answer is also no.
Well, to NBC, to the web now. Yeah. To the web, sometimes it's 15 seconds.
Right.
In Europe, there's no, I mean, there's 45 seconds.
Sure.
But there's rarely a 37 or a 26. So why not learn to play by the rules and make choices? And I think what's hurting creativity is, well, you saw how reality sort of dumbed down entertainment for a while. But then it became more clever. The ideas, DIY divorce.
Right.
DIYD.
Hillbilly hand vision. No, it's like genius. It's so clear.
Right.
It's so clear. Yeah.
So it's the boundaries force people to be more creative. So I think with more competition of products and the proliferation of digital tools means anybody can go out and shoot something for their website or their small product, right? Well, after a while, it's like, wow, that's first, it's really cool. Then it's like, oh, more of this shit.
Right.
So then you have to have a – it comes down to the writing.
Right.
And I, as a director, you know, I have no problem saying it's the writer. Because the writer, be it a guy scribbling on a napkin or a drawing or a script or – if it ain't on the page – it ain't on the stage. I mean, even a documentary, you watch the footage and you write what needs to be said in order to put the pieces together.
Right.
So that's what I think has to happen is the more content that is being pushed out on the web and on our phones and on television, the better the content has to be to rise to the top.
Well, that sounds like good news for,
that's great
for
news.
You, a guy who has a background as a comedian and as an entertainer.
It's a challenge.
It's not just
a
guy who can do a technical thing.
That was a long answer. I apologize.
No, it's good, though.
I kind of got,
to sum it up, you know, what's changing in commercials is competition is steeper than ever.
Yeah.
You got to grab people.
Yeah. And within, like, analogous to the comedy waves. You know, when I started, there were a couple hundred comedians. Yeah. Now there's thousands. Same thing with commercials. I think I came kind of late to the game, but in the late 90s. And now I've been doing it a long time, and there's thousands of directors. So the competition for... Like I tell my myself and my friends, I may be an A-plus filmmaker, like just technically experience and proficiency, but I'm a B-minus commercial director. And they're like, why do you say that?
Yeah, why do you say that?
Well, because there's the marketplace dictates that there's the A-plus guys. There's 12 guys that get every job. And like comedy jobs, there's like 5 guys, and they're great. Like the guy who did all, Tom Koontz, you don't know the name, but he did all those Old Spice commercials. We love I'm on a Horse.
Yes.
Tom Koontz, he's a go-to guy. And then when he passes, there's this, this is B plus A minus level. And then I'm right there. I'm in solid B.
Okay.
Yeah, solid B. But B minus is funnier to say. Like in conversation, if I say I'm a B, that's, it's a little confusing. Yeah. Like, oh, I'm a B. Maybe I'll say B plus. B plus is funny.
Yeah, it's okay. No, B minus, I think.
B minus
is
funnier.
Yeah.
Because it's self deprecating.
Yeah, exactly.
Right.
Yeah. A lot of that. I need a little stand up advice. Actually.
Yeah.
I have a stand up question, which is about me.
Yeah, please.
Like I said, I've been writing for a year and a half, maybe 2 years, and it's okay, you know. But I noticed that things are not working. My shit is not totally together. And last week was the first time I ever went up there and I had nothing to say.
Mm.
On purpose.
For that thrill.
Well, I think here's the question. I think I need to do more of that. What I did was I had nothing prepared. I deliberately didn't do that. And I got an idea from the person, some guy that went up 2 or 3 guys before me. And I thought that the stuff he was talking about was ridiculous. And I just went off on him and just fucked him up. He had already left, which is totally fine. But so the question is, I have a feeling that I just need to do more of this. And the question is, am I on the right track, or what am I going to learn by going up there without having my material prepared?
First of all, I'm only an assistant life coach, so anything that I say, you may want to run by someone else.
I might want to put in some Spanx.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
I'll answer. First of all, you answer your question. You know that you need to do more of it.
Yeah.
You didn't really ask me. You want me to validate, and I do agree with you, that you need to do it because it's fun. And it allows your comedic persona to get the laugh versus the jokes.
All right, now this is the news part. This is information.
Yeah.
Yeah, what's the difference there?
So I just did a rant about the writing for the commercial.
Sure.
So that's because that is that's something that's going to last and has to be repeatable. Now, depending upon your motive as a stand-up comedian, if you're in the business of selling you as a stand-up to get booked on the Tonight Show with Jimmy Fallon or whatever you want to do, or you want to develop a special, then hone that material and work on that material. If you're doing stand-up comedy for the joy of it, like I do, like I'm not in the business of selling Jordan Brady stand-up comedian. I go up and make fun of the room. I love doing what you did. I'm jealous. If a guy had a Malcolm X tattoo, and I said, you know, oddly, coincidentally, I have one, a tramp stamp of him on my ass. It's so great, and it's out of honor, right? And the place went nuts because the guy showed his tattoo. I said, I can't show you; that would be rude. But you know, and just riffing off of the room, what's been happening, because it's a live event,
right?
So it's like, if you're going to go see Maroon 5 in concert, you probably get a really rehearsed show. But if you go to the Hotel Cafe in Hollywood, you're going to see somebody just play. It's a very intimate kind of thing.
Right.
So I like the experience of doing stand-up for the moment.
Uh-huh.
For the live, what's going to happen, there's no net of it all. There's a show called The Set List. I've never done it.
Yeah, I'm
familiar
with
it. But Paul Provenza puts it on. He's okay.
Where they give you the topic at the last moment.
They shine it on the screen behind you.
Got it.
There's a word or two.
Got it.
And you act like it's part of your routine. So the audience sees it, and the comedian kind of glances behind her and says, oh, there's the topic, and they weave it in. It's so brilliant.
Right.
Now, improv doesn't work on television that well because you kind of had to be in the room. Even if you know all the parameters,
right.
It just doesn't translate.
Something doesn't work, yeah.
So to answer your question, I think you need to do more of it because it allows your comic mind, your comic persona, like that, I don't know if it's the id or the yeah. essence of your comedy.
What I care about.
Is pure.
When I'm doing that stuff.
When you're doing no planned material.
And when I write, you're always in your head on some level. Yeah. You're saying what's going to be funny here. And yeah.
Now there are those listening going, well, Jerry Seinfeld hones it to the syllable. Chris Rock is a very meticulous writer. One of my favorite comedians,
sure.
right? Probably one of the best writers.
Sure.
But that's when he's doing the bigger shows. Like if he's working out material, if he goes impromptu at the Comedy Store, he's going to work out these ideas.
And I also think that those guys have both of these parts working.
Absolutely.
And so I think based on what you're saying, I'm like, yeah, okay, that's why it feels good.
But they're in the business of selling Jerry Seinfeld. They're in the business of selling Chris Rock. Whether they call it that or not.
But also, these guys, they are connected with what their voice is,
yeah.
what their point of view is, and how to play that with the audience. And then they have their writing. And I think you need to have both those parts. If you're going to be Jerry Seinfeld, yeah, you got to have both those parts.
Todd Barry is a great comedian. He did an entire tour for about a year or so
yeah.
called the Crowdwork Tour. Where he And I went to see him at the Ecoplex or something in Silver Lake, right? Hip
yes.
part of L.A. Not a comedy club. It's his fans coming. Now, that's what's great about the internet and comedy
yeah.
and podcasts and radio shows. It used to be, when I grew up with the three networks and the major whatevers, even with cable when it first started, you had to appeal to a lot of people. Now, you and I can have a devout, small but intense following of people that dig what we're saying, and we like them. It's no longer a one-way thing. You can interact with your people and tweet and do a show and commercial directing boot camp. It's limited to 20 people. I wish it could be 12. But financially, I gotta rent a space,
work,
I gotta
yeah.
fly. Yeah, I can't do it. But 20 after 20, I'm like, I don't want it to be like 100. Somebody said, well, why don't you go to a film school and you can have 200 people in the crowd and you do your lecture. And okay, but that's
why
not
would
really
you want to do that?
That's not my gig.
Yeah.
So you have to do more of what you're talking about.
Yeah, I think it scared me for a long time. Well, I think in the beginning I just resisted it, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because I wanted to write some stuff and be clever, and I did that, and that's all great. And then I just said, ooh, that's a little scary.
Don't you have a couple in your back pocket, though? I mean, if it came to a lull, you got a couple of bits that you could whip out and slide into.
Yeah, I'm trying not to do that. I mean, there are topics. I can talk about my dad. I could do that for hours. But I could, it's only 4 or 5 minutes. I mean, but I don't even want to – I'm even kind of resisting that. I mean, that actually could be okay. I can talk about my dad. I can talk about the driverless car. I could talk about...
What's the driverless car bit?
That just came up recently. Rick Overton? Do you know that guy?
Rick Overton.
Yeah, he was just here a minute
ago. One of my favorite comedians.
Yeah, he and I were talking about that. The driverless car business is that I realize I don't want a driverless car. Because now what you have is you're going to sit there and you can't take a nap or, be totally wasted. You have to still kind of pay attention.
Yeah.
But now you can't speed. You can't honk your horn. You can't drive around that person. You can't have road rage. You can't do anything. And that's the only fun that you have
right?
driving is driving like an asshole. That's the only thing that's entertaining about it. And so for myself, I realized this is my gun issue. It doesn't make any sense. It's totally irrational. What I want is the freedom to open carry this 2,000-pound metallic weapon, you know, and use it at will when I see fit.
That's funny.
But, yeah, that's the, where it came. I was like, this is my gun issue. I don't – yeah, I want to be an asshole on the road. I'm from Philadelphia. And so, you know – to me, the highway on L.A. is the only time I can really be me.
Get all Philly on people.
Yeah, I could yell, scream, throw shit out the window, you know, run people off the road. Like, that's the authentic person that I am.
Sure.
And in L.A., the only time you can be that is on the freeway.
You can't do that at Trader Joe's.
I have to
be all cordial.
I tried. Trust me, I can't go to that Trader Joe's anymore.
You know, the thing about going up on stage without much planned, the only caveat I would say is, you don't want to sabotage the show. Meaning, you want to serve the greater good of the night for the audience.
Sure.
Like an I Am Road comic, available for $5 at iamroadcomic.com.
Yes. And JordanBrady.com.
And JordanBrady.com. Yep. But you know, go right to iamroadcomic.com. The comedian Wayne Fetterman, who's a dear friend of mine, back at the hotel after the first show, chastises me for doing too much crowd work. He said, because the MC went up, then I went up second. He closed the show. Mm. He said, you know, you do all this crowd work, and it trains the audience that they're going to talk to me. Right. And when I go up, I don't want to talk to them. So I have to do this 45 minutes. You know, you got to do your 25 minutes, talk to everybody in the crowd, do a bunch of jokes, and leave. Now, I've got to sort of start from ground zero in training them. Listen to what I have prepared. Hmm. So if you're going to derail a show, like in L.A., it's more of a comic. Yeah. On the road, it's MC middle headliner.
Yeah.
So that's the only caveat to that. Yeah, I think you have to serve comedy the great with the capital C.
That makes sense to me. I'll burn that bridge when I come to it. Yeah. I'm still at the very – I'm very unpopular. You know, so I'm not going to have that problem.
But again, the freedom.
Yeah.
Of not, my son went with me to a gig. They call, when I was a kid, they called them open mics when I first started.
Yeah.
Now they call them mics. They just call it a mic. So I did a mic in Koreatown, and I don't go to Koreatown a lot because I don't speak Spanish, which was my opening bit. Like I thought of as we pulled up.
Yeah.
And my son was with me, my younger son Ben, and he was cracking up, and I riffed on the room, and I talked to him, did what you did, talked about the other comics, like somebody mentioned Viagra, you know, here I am like twice their age talking about it. I take Viagra usually when I go to the car wash, and I wear sweatpants, and I just dare people not to look. Standing with arms akimbo, come on, here I am. Yeah. Like what?
Look
just
away.
Waiting,
look
just
away.
Waiting for my car.
Look away. Yeah.
So he was – the other comedians went up, and you could tell that they had really well-honed bits.
Right.
And they were practicing. And he asked me on the way home. And I go, well, those people, talented men and women, are practicing at the bar in Koreatown. So when they go to the Laugh Factory, the words have come out of their mouth. Like, it's better than doing it to themselves in the bathroom.
Sure.
And they've been on stage, and it's like muscle memory, if you will.
Yeah.
Because they're in the business of advancing as a comedian. So for a guy like me, 51, had a career in stand-up,
right,
doing it now for fun and to make
totally
documentaries,
right,
I don't give a fuck, which is such a liberating – it's like – What's the worst that's going to happen? I'm not invited back to Koreatown?
What, I mean, right, to an open mic, exactly.
It's crazy.
Yeah.
So if it were like, no, I got to make it, and I have a 3-year plan to get on the Late Late Show, maybe don't do that.
Yeah.
But if you're doing it because here in, I mean, in a way, stand up is it's not karaoke, but it is more accessible than it used to be.
Totally.
So I think everybody should try it. It's,
yeah,
you know, so. On the way here, last thing is, I texted my son, Jake, who did the show at the I.O., right, the improv show. He said, Dad, it felt so good to get those laughs. And I texted him on the, left him a message on the way here saying, of all the addictive genetics that I've handed down to you and your brother, that's the best one.
Yeah.
Right? Because if you're addicted to making people laugh, which is a sickness, ask Rick Overton. It is a disease. It's okay. Like, you know, you're not overly into porn or, you know, you
drugs, alcohol,
right?
Even video games. This is much better than video
games. Much better than video games. Jake, if you're listening, much better than video games.
Much better for all the kids at home. Well, Jordan Brady, I would like to thank you so much.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
For coming into the show.
What a great talk.
Yeah, no, this has been, this whole thing has been great. I've been meeting fantastic people, and yeah, it's been funny, hopefully.
Yeah,
been
hopefully.
Fun at the same time. And yeah, great. We talked about divorce for 20 minutes or more. That is great.
And I'm sure people have routines about divorce.
Yeah, I do. I got a good six, seven minutes. Yeah.
Are you going to post that? Like, can we go to YouTube and see?
I'm still working on it. I do it, but like I said, it's not totally landing. So I'm reworking it, and I need this other piece. I need this other piece. More of a connection.
Yeah.
You know, just anyway, yeah, I'm working on it, but I will let you know.
I'll come out to a show.
All right. If you would like to buy a Comedy Death Star coffee mug.
Who wouldn't?
You can email me at comedydeathstar@acsdigital.tv. Dylan Vigil is our producer and engineer. Our theme music was written and performed by Dean Mermel. You have been listening to Comedy Death Star, the official podcast of Actors Comedy Studio, right here in Hollywood, USA. On behalf of Jordan Brady, our guest, and myself, Denzel Myers, thank you for listening, and we will be back next week.